Le balado que tu t'apprêtes à écouter, tu peux pas l'entendre ailleurs. C'est une exclusivité.
88.3, c'est fac.
Ça part ici.
Tu fais partie d'un programme d'études en régime coopératif et tu as envie de partir travailler à l'international pendant tes études? Les stages hors Québec sont faits pour toi. Saisis cette opportunité, viens nous rencontrer au service des stages et du développement professionnel sur le campus principal au local B6 2005 ou visite le site usherbrooke.ca/stage. Cette émission est commanditée par le service des stages et du développement professionnel.
Bonjour et bienvenue à Mille et une voix du succès. Aujourd'hui, on a le plaisir de recevoir Richard Pierre-Gilles, un enseignant au secondaire en anglais qui a joué presque professionnellement au soccer et qui a une carrière et une vie tellement riche et diversifiée en expériences. C'est une discussion qui va être fort inspirante.
Absolument. Puis aussi, à mentionner, c'est une discussion qui va être en anglais. Donc, oui, une première discussion en anglais. Donc, ça va être... Ça
Stay
va être
tuned!
Oui, absolument. Donc, pour bien faire face à ce périple mouvementé qu'est la vie...
Inspirons-nous de ceux l'ayant déjà vécu.
Bienvenue, chers amis,
à Mille et une voix du succès. Well, hello everyone. Welcome to Mille et une voix du succès. This is our first episode in English. Very happy to be here. Today, we have the joy of welcoming Richard Pierre-Gilles on our podcast. Now, I'll give a little backstory before we get into it. Richard was actually my English enriched teacher when I was in high school here in Sherbrooke in Salesien. Also taught our technical director, Thomas, behind the scenes there, taking care of the cameras and the montage. And I was always... You know, I always went into his class and came out of the class a changed man every time. So I thought that inspiring young people was right up his alley. So we invited him on the podcast and hopefully we'll have a nice discussion today. And so welcome, Richard. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure.
The invitation.
It's a pleasure.
How about you? How about we start off with you tell us a bit, you know, how's your how your journey, your parcours has been since high school. You know, how did you end up here?
Well, since high school, I went to high school at Les Salesiens. So
really?
There's an old TV show called Welcome Back, Carter, where an old teacher went back to his high school and taught some students and stuff. So I always felt connected to that. And I spent 5 years, but when I went to at Les Salesiens, it was an all-boys school.
Oh,
so
really?
There's no girls. Good. Yeah, at all. And there was and I was the last generation of all boys, and then we finished in June, and the following fall, the girls came in, so I never got to know the girls at high school. So I...
well, that must have been a shame there.
Yeah, it was. But you see, my wife was the first generation of high school girls at Les Salesiens. I didn't know her back then. But a couple of years into it, when I went to Cégep in Sherbrooke, and I was heavily involved in soccer and sports and all, and you're probably going to hear about that.
Oh, yeah.
And I was and I was invited back to the Salesian to give prizes for their sports award, athletic awards. And going there, I gave a trophy to my wife-to-be.
Oh my God.
She was in Sec 2.
You know, life is
what
really
goes
interesting.
Around, comes around.
It's
you know?
Funny because we have pictures of that, and because I was on the national team at the time for soccer, and they invited me back, so I was giving a trophy for soccer to her, and the picture remained in the family. And later, when I had children, well, I have children. I have two boys. They saw the picture as toddlers, and they thought that was our first wedding. That's how they said
okay.
it. They called it before, you know. And but we didn't know each other that much. So I went to Cégep here, and very, I couldn't call it tragic, but a defining moment happened when my father passed away. I was at Cégep first year. I was 17 years old. And a year later, I decided to leave and go study at the University of Prince Edward Island. It was I only went there for a semester, just based on a buddy soccer player I highly respected, and he said, "Well, come over," and he just laid down everything for me to to arrive there.
So you went there because you wanted to disconnect from the reality of...
I needed to leave. I needed to go.
Take some distance.
Yeah, to take some distance. Exactly. Those are the exact words. So taking some distance, I discovered a new place and I started anew with some things unresolved, but still a new lease on a new life. And going there, I only imagined staying for maybe a semester, a year, and ended up spending 5 years.
If I could ask, and if I could ask, at that point, when you went to Prince Edward Island, did you have a plan in mind? What was your vision for the future? What did you see for yourself?
I didn't have a plan. My plan was just to leave.
Okay.
My plan at that time, to get away, and my plan was, but I did have something. I said to myself, can I actually practice my sport, my passion, which was soccer, and get an education in English, and make something of it. And it was kind of strange because when I went there, funny thing happened. I believe in fortunate. I told you guys the serendipity. One of the first words I ask you. So those are happy occurrences. When I decided to go to PEI, on that flight from Montreal to Prince Edward Island, I was flying behind Stevie Wonder.
What?
Stevie Wonder was like a legend at the time. We're talking like early 80s.
Yeah.
And a fluke thing that happened, I was flying alone because the university, the coach had sent me tickets. So they laid the red carpet for me to go. And waiting there, I talked to some guy because I was... fairly, open and happy-go-lucky person. Not too shy. And this is perhaps something that I could send out because I saw this guy. There's some kind of a connection. I can't define it. I can't explain it. I decided to talk to the guy. So I talked to the guy, and then we start talking, and next thing he says, I ask him, he says, I'm in a band. Okay, you're in a band. There are thousands and millions of bands. But I say, a few minutes later, what band? And he very shyly replied, I'm with Stevie Wonder. So what are you talking about to Stevie Wonder? As we're walking towards the gate to board, and I yanked the guy back. I says, what are you talking about? And he starts laughing. He says, what do you do there? He says, I'm a technical engineer, sound engineer. I said, yeah, Tom, there's a career for you. and then I said, look, this guy's been a legend and someone I had highly admired and stuff. And where is he? He says, well, he's right in front of you. And I see him like walking with his girls, the choir or whatever, and him, and all dressed in sort of African looking suit and stuff. And he's passing through. And I'm going to say, and he goes, do you want to talk to him? I said, to pig flies, man.
I don't know if I can talk to
pig fly. I said, yeah. So we walk and we get to the waiting place. And then I see this guy. He had been playing in Montreal and he took the plane to play in Halifax. And that's where it was headed. Except that they took a different route. Because they were going to PI before Halifax, and normally it would be Halifax and PI. So I get to the waiting room and says, hey, Stevie, there's someone who wants to meet you. This is the one time in my life where I was totally stunned and no
Richard
words.
At a loss for
at
words.
At a loss
now,
for
I
words.
Would have paid to see that.
Look, man, I tell that story because I see him. And I know he's blind, so it's just, brilliant. So when he says that, Stevie just goes, presents his hand to me. And I just take his hand and he's giving this cool handshake. And say, what's going on, man? And I'm like, he says, Mr. And I don't know what to call him. Yeah, do I call him Mr. Wonder?
Yeah, exactly. Mr. Wonder, Stevie.
Do I call him Stevie? We're not that close, I'm like...
What'd you settle on?
I said everything.
Mr. Stevie Wonder, hello, sir.
Mr. Stevie with the... And I say the dumbest thing is I could be at your show because, this. And I say, it's all right, man, and all that. And he... I see this little girl come up, and she shows me a drawing and says, look, this is what I did and all that. And that's his daughter. And that's the girl he wrote the song, like, isn't she lovely?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my God,
isn't
yeah.
she wonderful?
You saw the girl of that song.
Aisha. That's a, and Aisha. I see her. She showed me, it's so cute. So I'm having this connection. And then I think it's a producer or whatnot that I don't have much love for. Because he just came up and says, look, it's enough. He needs to rest and whatnot. And I said, okay, cool. I'm just going to pull away. And he says, we'll send you a picture or whatnot. And then I said, okay. Never got the picture, by the way. But
still waiting on that.
Still waiting. But I hop on the plane after this moment. Who am I sitting behind? Stevie Wonder.
Again,
oh on the flight from Montreal to PI, I'm sitting on behind him. And the next morning, this is the only proof that I have of having done that. It's on that flight, there was a couple of basketball players from New York who were recruited, and they were going to play on the PI team. And when I go for breakfast at McDonald's in PI the next morning, and this guy's looking at me, is this 6'5 guy is looking at me, says, what are you doing here? I said, what am I doing? What? He says, I saw you on the flight the other day, and I thought that you were part of the band that was with Stevie Wonder. So now I see you here, you know? I said, no. So anyways, that's how I went to PI. Spent the semester, first semester, we were champions. Okay. That in the history of university,
there you go.
The university had never won any championships, but we went on to have an undefeated season.
Wow.
And for 3 years, we won or tied every game except for the last one in the third year. So we
won or tied all games for
all
three.
Games
Let's
for 3 years.
Stop for a second and there. That's amazing.
And Wait. It was a tough conference. When we came in, it was the toughest conference in Canada because all the teams had either participated in the nationals or anything else. So we had like six Quebecers on the starting 11. And
so what was the key to that success?
Yeah,
how do you win?
Is it a coincidence that you came in and all of the
me. No, I'm not saying
it was all him.
It's just gosh, if you know me, this is not the. No, it's just that it's a bunch of things that happened at the same time. Like a lot of the strong Quebec soccer players who had either played semi-pro or at the national level or international level, they decided they were recruited, quote unquote, and decided to come to PI and. We had a solid team, and we made history there because of that, and also because it was such a small university that we drew a crowd to support us. We had like thousands of people come to our game. In fact, in the first playoff we played there, there was snow like today, and we thought that we wouldn't play the conference finals because there was so much snow. The crowd and the athletic director took out shovels and cleared the field for us. It was a snowbank around the field when we played the final, and thousands of people screaming and yelling. And so anyways, this is a pretty fabulous thing.
And so you've been playing soccer, or at that point you've been playing soccer since you were young, right?
Yeah, I did. I played soccer, played hockey, did a lot of martial arts as well, Kyokushin. And
what?
Kyokushin Kai, that's the martial art that Georges St-Pierre
did. Oh, yeah.
And in fact, my sensei, who's 73 years old now, was the sensei who gave Georges St-Pierre his second degree black belt.
You got taught by the same sensei as Georges St-Pierre.
Right. Actually, it's the opposite, because I got taught.
You got taught.
Georges St-Pierre got taught by
your
I'm 60 years old, man. Georges St-Pierre's only a toddler. No, but I did. And we got in contact. He reached out a few years back during COVID, and we traced him back. So he's in Florida now and teaching, still teaching.
And why were you so into sports? Like, what drove you? How did that come to be? Because you seem to be performing at a very high level in a few different sports, and that was something that obviously required a tremendous amount of time when you were young. A lot of investment, a lot of self-discipline. So where does that all come from?
Well, it comes from the fact that we didn't have medication like we have now, since I had to spend time outside because that drive my parents crazy. Mm-hmm. So I was involved in a lot of things a lot of times. So I got into, I had to be outside, I had to be active, which, by the way, helped me understand my youngest son. My younger son was a bit like me, having to just express himself and spend a lot of energy. I remember one time, and I had to make a decision, because that one particular time as a teen, I had this karate competition. There was a regionals in East Angus in the morning. In the afternoon, I had a soccer game to prep for the Quebec Games, and my hockey bag was ready, because we had I was playing double A hockey at the time, and we had to drive up to Granby for a hockey game. That was one day. So that's when my parents sat me down and said, you got to make a choice now. You got to make a decision. Mm-hmm. And I just dropped playing the guitar, because, you know, I played conservatory for a bit. So I chose soccer and karate, but I had dropped hockey. I really, really had to, I learned a lot from karate, I guess it would be something that we can apply in everything. I was reading someplace, it was like, to be able to perform at a certain level, you know what, it comes from, I'm wondering if it's not Tyson who said that, you gotta love what you hate to do, mm-hmm. to get to what, you know, where you want
to go. You have to love what you hate to do to get where you want
to
go.
Yeah. To a certain extent. Like,
that's
the
fundamentals for discipline.
Exactly.
I think.
There's a difference between motivation and discipline. Motivation, you can, you know, motivate yourself to do something great one time, and that's it. But discipline will get you to do that thing 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's delve into there, because I feel like there's more than meets the eye there. So I feel like a lot of people don't, like, for example, discipline themselves to do sports, and they say they lack motivation. What would you say to those people? How do you get that discipline?
Well, I think you get it from purpose.
Yeah.
What is the purpose of what you're doing? What does that mean to you? And how is it going to serve you for you to be able to serve the world? Because at one point, at even a small scale, what I mean by serving the world could be something just to offer people a moment where they're going to forget their troubles, and you're performing or you're doing something where they feel good about seeing what you're doing. It could be in the world of arts. When we pay big bucks to go see a concert, give a name. Doesn't matter who it is. People pay thousands of dollars to see that. The football game, that's not going to change someone's life. Mm. It's not going to cure cancer. But people are willing to pay that much money to forget about their lives for a brief moment. So that is meaningful. So for me, oh, that was you. Okay. Right. So for me, that's how I think that people can get some reason, some definition of how important what they're doing is going to be. It's going to be. Another thing is, where attention goes, energy flows. We hear that sometimes. Mm-hmm. Wherever you put your attention on, whatever it is, that's where you get the impetus. That's where you get the drive to do things, good or bad. So wherever your attention is going to be placed, whatever that is, in sports, arts, something that's not necessarily legal, or something that's totally, that can drive you, your total focus, your energy, and everything that you draw from everywhere is zeroing in on that accomplishment you're seeking. So what you're looking for, that's where you draw it. So where your energy goes, where your focus, you know, goes, that's where your energy flows.
But that's crazy, because, I mean, it sounds pretty, not intuitive, but easy to do, right? Like, I mean, saying like this, but for a reason or another, when we do something, or, like, you know, something that's hard, that can be like a class that you find particularly hard or whatever, it's like almost counter nature, like, effort to put your attention into something to write. You know,
humans like to avoid pain.
Yeah, and
short-term gratification.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Especially today.
But even if it's for, you know, learning something or to be disciplined, you know, there's a bit of suffering from that. And I think like every suffering moments or anything that you learn, like
you learn to love the pain in a way, but
in a way maybe,
but
yeah,
but to do but that, what's really interesting is you need that purpose, because you need the sense that you're driving towards something, so you can put your focus in it, but you need to feel like you're going somewhere, because otherwise you're imposing pain upon yourself meaninglessly, and I don't know how long people can do that.
So what was your purpose to, you know, compete in high sports like this?
Well, just to backtrack just a little before, and this is something that I got from people who influenced me as well, because I've been interested in human development for decades, you know, and I'm talking about 40 years almost, 35 years. And one of the things that you get from some of these people who are either coach or direct or help people, is just you give meaning. And the meaning will give you emotions. And the emotion that you get will help the decision.
No, I don't understand that.
So, in meaning, in the sense that, let's say for me, sports. Sports was meaningful because it allowed me to express myself, to free myself, and to feel, to build a certain sense of confidence. And to also, when you don't know who you are for a certain moment, this can help define you. But it cannot be too long, because we are not defined by what we do. We should not be defined but just solely by what we do. But it's a good starting point when you don't know who you are. So as a kid, if you're good at something, it's going to help you open doors towards other things. And eventually you'll see from all the experiences, you can get some kind of meaning for yourself. So what does it mean for me to play soccer? It means that I can surpass myself. I can overcome challenges. I can see how I am in this kind of a universe. Mm-hmm. And it helps me look at myself through a different lens. So I go through different emotions as well, because I win, I'm happy. I lose, I'm sad. But then I realize that losing is not necessarily what defines me either. Losing is part of the process, because I won't win every game and I won't win the championship every year. So that also helps me understand about life, because life is exactly that. You lose more often than you win.
Yeah.
And it's through all those losses that you pile them up and you gain experience from these that you can eventually appreciate the moments, the short times that you
the
get
victories.
Exactly. Yeah. So this, and then those victories, as you become a little more, I guess, experienced, mature and everything, you realize that there's more to that than just winning.
Winning is not the you know, like the finality or
exactly
something.
Exactly. And losing is not the end of it too.
Mm.
Right. So you use all those quote-unquote losses as stepping stones and growing experience. I like to say, when I ask people, and you know that I love quotes, and one of my and one of my quotes that I actually through experience I asked the students at one point in time, what is the quote that, you know, I think defines. I had to do it for myself, and humbly. One that I came up with was life is a growing/glowing experience. Life is a growing/glowing experience. What do you change? One letter. You change one letter and it changes the entire thing.
And what is growing/glowing?
It means what Nelson Mandela would say. Mandela would say, I always win. I never lose. I either learn or I win.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yeah.
So what it means that every experience is a learning experience regardless. So when you look at it that way, you're no longer afraid of losing, because you know it's part of the process for you to grow.
Yeah.
Right. And so you, well, I mean, I think we actually have a mentality that, that relates to that very much. And it's this, this idea that you're continuously growing, right? Mm-hmm. This idea that everything negative, be it life, be it some life happens randomly, catastrophe happens and such. There's always something to get from it. And you can always see, like, it's, you don't have to see right away the positive side to it,
but
if you keep
say, like,
if you keep your mind open and trust in life, I think that there's always good that's going to come from it, right?
Yeah. So, for instance, you said that a defining moment for you was when you lost your father.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn from that loss?
Well, let's start with, how about you walk us through that a bit first?
Well, okay, because it's a very important moment. I was practicing. There's a lot I learned from this before, during, and after. Before, there was a camp after the national championship in Toronto at the time, and they pre-selected some players from all provinces, and they sent you to a camp. Camp was in, I think, I can't remember, but it was in Ontario. So I was at camp, but I, coming back from that camp, my mom drove to Montreal and told me, your father's sick on the way back, so that's why he didn't come to see you. So I get to my place and I see my father with jaundice, you know, it's yellow. And so that's the liver that's kind of, stopping. And I'm playing at Cégep, and then eventually there were no spalitude at the time. So I'd have to drive up to Montreal and I'd leave Sherbrooke. I'd finish school at 4, right?
Right.
Rush to the bus station downtown Sherbrooke, take the at 5, the bus would leave for Montreal, get to Montreal, Berry-UQAM at 7, rush to the camp was with Claude Robillard at the time, so practice from 8 to 10, and then you rush back from Claude Robillard to Berry-UQAM because the last bus for Sherbrooke was at 11 o'clock at night, and you get home at 1 in the morning, and we get back to school the next day.
How many times a week?
It could happen 1 to 3 times a week.
Jeez.
So we could do that for a while. And I was, after a while, they had camps in different parts of the country, and before they rally everyone. And they had pre-selected 4 other guys and not me, because I traveled back and forth. So I asked for permission if I could still train with the team, because I had been there for a few weeks, and they said yeah, because okay, so that's fine. And back to what you're saying, life happens for you. My goal was to improve. At that point I said, look, I was sad, but at least how good can I get amongst all these guys? Something happened at a higher level at the Canadian Association. They changed coaches. And that coach decided to come back and say, look, I want to see all the players that were pre-selected, and I'm going to visit every province and see what's up. So I happened to be there that one practice. I knew that coach was coming. And I wanted to just give my best performance to at least. And I, honestly, I'll tell you, I could do no wrong that practice.
It went well.
Oh, it's just like I was flying
sometimes,
and I was in flow.
Yeah,
it's just like I'm in the zone, man,
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So practice is over. And funny thing happened. That coach who had cut me off was asked by the national coach to come and see me and to tell me that I was invited to camp.
So the dreams are coming true now. They're starting to happen.
And they are. So that one time that I knew I was going to go to camp, and I knew that, said, just get me to that camp, man. I'm going to give you every reason not to send me back. I was sent back once.
Yeah.
I didn't like
Never
it.
Again,
you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to do everything. You just tell me what I need to do. I'm just going to
You had that fire in your
oh,
eyes.
Oh, yeah.
There.
I was just like, you know, this is it.
The drive was there.
Oh, yeah. But the unfortunate thing is that one time, driving back home, 1 o'clock in the morning, 1:15, we get the phone call. My dad's dead. So I never had a chance to tell him that I had made the camp. He was supporting me and everything. Yeah. So coming back, and that nearly destroyed me.
I must have felt like the most unresolved.
For years.
Yeah.
Because I did not know that. We don't know all these things. But I'm telling you, I'm 60 years old. This happened when I was in the early 80s, you know. So I have to go back to school the next day to do my economics midterm. I'm in such a you know, blur. I go to the test. I miserably failed. And I come back and we have to, you know, start thinking about arrangements and stuff. And it's one of my friends at school who saw me at the test. What the F you doing here, man? You know, because he knew I didn't tell anybody because I, you know, keeping things, you know, I didn't want to. And he told the teacher, told the professor. And the next class professor comes up to me and said, what were you doing there? He says, no, you're going to retake that test. You're going to take the time you need to mourn and everything. And then we're going to do this and we're going to do this orally. And so I went through this phase where I went to camp and I made the team. And you know what? Eventually, all the pre-selected players before them, none of them were selected. I was the only Quebecer on the national team that year. That's an under 20 national team. So we went to Guatemala, and before that we went to Mexico, played against the Olympic team there, and did well. I was on the bench, put me on. We were losing 3-2, did the corner kick that tied the game. And so things were going, and then I went through university. And when you ask me why I went there, it's because that's just before all this that I'm telling you happened before I decided to go. I said, something's wrong. I just got to get out, which I did. So that's when I went to I didn't stay with this team. And when I was called back for the Olympics, because I was on the list, I was already at university. And the association had no money. So I'd have to pay my way and leave university. The conditions weren't right. And even the professional level, I was with the equivalent of the Impact just before leaving, I was practicing and training with the farm team of the Impact. And we played exhibition games. I played some of the top players who came down and we played games. So I was projecting myself as a professional soccer player. And the league folded because of lack of money.
Yeah.
But all these guys that were the top guys on the national team and they're the ones who went to that 1986 World Cup. So my buddies I played with, before we saw the World Cup, you know, the World Cup was in 2022. I can't remember. Like the one in Qatar?
In Qatar. Yeah. I think it's 2022.
And they were talking about the last generation.
Yeah.
Those are my guys.
Huh.
So those are the guys I played with.
Interesting.
So so I didn't get to play soccer at that level. Went to university, but I played at the university level. And later I played the elite level. But at the university, it's when university finished. When it ended, and I had to work. So my environment changed. That's when everything started flooding back.
From your dad?
From my dad, from my relationship with that girlfriend that had broken down, and from school that I had invested my focus on, yeah. and really did well soccer, but everything just came, you know, falling apart, and I had to do something.
And so... In a way, would you say that, I wouldn't say Barry, but I have some experience with what you're relating.
Yeah.
And do you feel like you kind of pushed it down for a period and it all came back at that point?
And that's a life lesson. You asked me what I learned. It's like whatever you flee. There's a quote that summed it up. It's like what you... gosh, I don't have the exact words, but it's whatever you try to avoid comes back to you, you know?
10 times harder, right?
Harder, yeah.
And you said you had, in the same time, there's a girlfriend that happened there that was a very significant relationship of yours.
Well, I was living with her, and we'd been together 3 years.
And it didn't work out.
Well, no, and it's okay that it didn't work out, because it's not necessarily the person that would have been good for me. And she was good for that time. And that's another thing, is, you know, people... happen in your life, and that's the thing. The people that you will meet will either be some people who are going to be helping you, or they will be either helping or teaching. So it's either a lesson or a blessing. So the people that you meet will either be a blessing or a lesson.
And in both ways, that's kind of a blessing, ways, right?
And exactly. Mm-hmm. So it was like both for me.
And so you're now in this, let's put you in that context, you're now in this tremendous darkness. Uni's finishing, your environment's changing, your relationship with your girlfriend is over. Everything's flooding back from your dad. At that point, I imagine, or I can very well picture, that you are now kind of like, I don't know if you see the way out at that point. How do you get out of there? How do you progress?
Oh, I had help. I had help. I had help with a gentleman that really gave me perspective into what I was going through, because it's also clear nowadays how people were involved in sports for so intensely. When that sport ends, they lose sight of who they were. And that's the reason why initially I said that you can be defined by something, but not too long. So I was a soccer player all my life.
So now you're lost.
And now you're lost. You're no longer, who am I, you know? And all these questions come back. And then what you resist persists, right?
Yeah.
What you resist persists. So I got into teaching. I got into different things at school. But then I went back to soccer. Okay, and I went back to a passion as well that came back, playing the guitar a little bit. And I discovered, I opened myself up to other things as well, because of context, you know. So that moment, that's when I met my wife-to-be. So coming back here, I didn't want to teach anymore. When I came back, I left PI, I was teaching there first year. I came back here in Sherbrooke, and I didn't consider myself a teacher, so I was in the imposter syndrome for years. For years, I was just doing something, and I didn't think that was the thing for me, but I was doing it, right? And because the one person was very influential when I was at high school, who had become the principal, told me, says, Richard, you know, I met him at the Carrefour coming back. He said, Richard, we need some people. He said, no, I'm not much of a teacher, and I quit, but if you need me to, well, we have these students entering the summer class, you can come and help them. Yeah, sure, okay, I'll do that. So, and then he goes, hey, summer class is over, we might be needing some people to substitute teach, you know, I can do that. It's not teaching? No. He knows I don't want to.
No, it's not teaching, it's just substitute teaching.
Okay, I'll try that, you know. And then he says, oh, you know what, we have a little contract here. So it's only two classes. The classes that we don't have anymore, Latin. I had taken Latin back.
No, for some reason, Richard Pierre-Gilles teaching Latin does not surprise me.
I taught Latin. I had taken Latin for 3 years intensively, translating Caesar, translating all these. I swear to God. So I got involved in like the etymology and trying to feed students that to make it practical, really. And the other thing that I was teaching was like word perfect, you know, it's computer, and they called it informatique, but it had nothing to do. I didn't know anything. I didn't know how to turn on the computer.
What were you doing in that class?
Yeah, what were you doing there?
They said I got a job doing this. So what I said, we're going to learn how to type at the time, you know, learn how to type. And we had some of your audience might remember that, the floppy disks and the diskettes and stuff. Mm-hmm. So we were into that. Spent most of our time trying to load the computer. So in an hour class, it'd take a half hour to load the computer. So I didn't have to plan much, you know. And then you do, you know, stuff. So, and the rest of it was substitute teaching. And he says, you know, I got room for 2.5 teachers, so you can do that. And that's almost like a full-time job. So I did that for a couple of years until I got a contract, you know, teaching history, and then got involved into English. Did my English here at the University of Sherbrooke, and ever since, you know, that was like the main course of my professional career.
So why did you, like, how did the mentality change from, oh no, you know, I'm not a teacher, to let's do it, I'm a teacher?
Yeah, well, you see, this is very interesting, because my oldest son was born in 1995, so he's 28 now. I got to Salisbury in 1990. So I think it took me about 5-6 years to finally, and my second son was in 1998. So when you become a father, I had flaws, very evident flaws before I became a father. I was late a lot.
So punctuality?
Punctuality was an issue.
One of the flaws.
Oh, it was a big issue for me. And also because I wanted to do so many things. Mm-hmm. So punctuality was not so much that I was dragging my butt, everything. No, it's more like I didn't want to miss out on anything. So I'd take way too much. You know, I'd just like, can you be there at 8? Yeah, yeah. I say, can you be there at 10? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, you know what I mean? And it's like you're going like you say yes to everything, and then you come up and you go, shoot, there's only 24 hours in that day.
I'm going to do a quick parallel here. we get what you're saying here because, like, for me, what I've been told, if my sisters listen to this, they're going to repeat this. What I've been told is, like what I see it as, if my schedule goes perfectly to the second, I'll get everything done. So I wasn't over-planning it. But then, of course, you know, you get 10 minutes here, 10 minutes here. You're going to be late all the time. And, no, we get – I mean, Charles, you get that. We're always late. We're always late.
And, yeah. Well, there you go, because we plan so tight and we want to do everything, you know. Mm-hmm. FOMO, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Big one.
So, anyways, all these things to say that it changed me. And so funny that because the gentleman who hired me, Pierre Duclos, when he hired me initially, he was and he knew that, you know, but I was involved in so many things. Just to give you an idea, in those first years, that's how I got to be organized. I was coaching university soccer. I was teaching full time. And eventually I became a parent. And doing that a lot, I had to schedule myself and I had to leave some things out because even my wife said, you know what, we have children. You cannot plan like 2-3 things in a day. We plan one thing with the kids mm-hmm. and we'll see if we can do another one because sometimes that one thing will take up the entire day. Mm-hmm. So I changed that. And one of the things it helped me coaching was that when I came into school to teach you guys, because I coached up until 2003, no, it's not true, because I started back coaching at University of Sherbrooke. I was at Bishops before and Sherbrooke in the up until 2011. But it taught me that when August came, my classes were ready till end of October or early November. I knew exactly what I was going to do because when coaching came, it was from August to November to early November. So I had to plan things, and I had to know where I was taking my team. And also, I had to be punctual because I had to lead by example. So if I wanted results, people don't hear what you say. They see what you do.
Yeah.
So when you do it, they look at it, and it has to be congruent. Whatever you shout out, you know, you got to walk the talk. And to me, there's nothing more telling than when you are seeking someone to follow or someone that could help you, inspire you, you were always looking at what they're doing, right? And
oh yeah,
yeah. So this is what I had to be. I'm on the spot all the time, so that changed me a lot.
Yeah, and I feel like your role as a teacher does that, right? Because I mean, even before like we started the podcast and anything, like Paul talked about. You know, you had an impact, and I'm sure that you have an impact on many students that, like, you know, you teach. And, you know, I never had you as a teacher because I was at the seminar, but...
We forgive you for that. That's okay.
Thanks. Thanks. Yeah, I don't have many supporters.
No, all right, okay. Salis. All right. I'm looking around, I'm like, okay, so who can...
You're a minority.
Nobody. All right.
The wrong
yeah, but
choice,
I had good friends
Charles.
At the Seychelles. Okay, good. I had good friends at Seychelles.
All right, thanks. So, yeah, I was wondering, what is your... How do you see yourself as a teacher? Maybe my question is too broad, but what is your goal? What is your purpose that you want to communicate, that you want to learn
as
your
teacher,
students
yeah.
as a teacher? Maybe it's more profound than the math.
No,
you
it's
know?
Good. But the subject is actually a pretense. It's a pretext. It's not something that okay. English to me is a vehicle.
Right.
And to me, it's a vehicle to establish a connection with the students. So some people have math, some people have history, French, whatever that is. My conception of education is exactly that, and that's an exchange. I stand to gain a lot from and perhaps a lot more from my students than they can gain from me. This is my stance. How? Because from who they are, and from where they're from, I have to adapt, adjust. I have myself to be morphed a little bit without losing my values, without losing who I really am, and to establish that connection. It's the most humbling profession, I think, because we get it right 1 year, but you repeat the same thing, you don't get it right because you have someone else in front of you or someone who brings their own experience of the world that confront yours.
As a student.
So I'm a
you need to connect with all these different people and you need to find a way to get through to them. And in a way, I'm just going to do a little parallel here. English is a great way to do that because even though you're teaching a subject, through the subject, essays and such, you can try to gain that connection. Whereas history or math, sometimes you're a bit more, you need to teach these things. But English is a means to communicate.
Absolutely. I've had the privilege of being fairly free now, of course, within the restrictions of the Ministry of Education and everything else, but to plant those seeds that now I see it, I feel so privileged, so honored to be here, and I have two of my students, former students here. To me, it's very telling, but it's also I feel honored because to me it's a lifelong experience. By the same token, I learn so much, and I think we grow from learning, and from having this stance of openness and I try to maintain that curiosity and that childlike sort of
wonder.
Yeah. And of course we falter, and there are years that are more difficult than others and whatnot, but that's the way life is, you know. But and that has helped me a lot, even to this day with some students where this is, you know, a new breed, quote unquote, of students with their own realities, their own challenges, and their own hopes and opportunities. So that to me is also refreshing because I also am learning to connect again and to be able to dispense whatever experience I have. And I always told students, I don't know if I told you guys that also, it's like what separates us is only a few years. So to me, it's not so much that, I feel grateful that you consider the experiences and that the time that we spent together worth your while and worthwhile and meaningful to you. But as I say, all I can offer is from the moment I was conscious enough to understand things, to this day, the road I've traveled, the experiences I've overcome, or some that I'm still wrestling with, and I can dispense a little bit of that to people and say, look, you're going to have to go through your own stuff. But here's, I can tell maybe the patterns. I can read a little better the patterns of life. And those patterns, many of them are pretty much the same, you know, less than the struggles and the keeping that mentality and all these things. No matter where you are on the planet, we're all human beings and we're all souls. Mm-hmm. So we have to go through these things. So I'm very passionate and interested about that part of us in the short moment we have on this planet and that we share. That to me is larger than just that subject I'm teaching, and it's larger than any subject that you'll take.
And so, if I, your objective here when you teach is not, I mean, sure, you're teaching the subject of English, but more than that, you're trying to equip young people, or to the best of your ability. You only have one semester with them, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not like you're as present as their parents or such, but you're trying to play a role in equipping them for what's to come, for what life is going to be like and for what they're going to face. If you can play a part in that preparation, you've done what you were there for.
Right? And that's exactly. We were talking about meaning. I draw meaning from that. I draw meaning from that, and how can I just play a small part and you play a bigger part? Sometimes you play no part at all because.
I mean, sometimes the kids, sometimes they're not open to receiving.
They're not ready.
Today, and what's fun with this podcast is that we feel like there's a lot to derive from people who have more experience than us, and mm-hmm. we feel like today that's increasingly, you know, kids are increasingly harder to connect with, are increasingly more. I wouldn't say ego gets in the way, but let's say they listen less to.
Well, I would be interested actually to hear your opinion about that, because that's a strong statement that you just made.
Yeah, like, but I get the sense that today young people are very quick to devalue experience and to devalue people with experience and what they have to say. And so I get the sense it's increasingly harder to connect with them or transmit or do what you're doing, right?
Is that
and
true?
You have that experience, right? You have those 20-something years at studies.
The thing is, and it's funny because there was this gentleman, his name escapes me. He says, we have more means of communicating, but we communicate less.
That's
one of the things I notice is that it's true that we are more distracted. Not so much that we don't find important to connect, because connection is at the heart of what you do when you're a student in high school. In fact, if I may just sidetrack it a little bit, I was reading someplace that, and I tell the students that, they said one of the biggest and the most important decision you're going to make is the choice of your friends, the choice of people that you're going to be with at that time. And study shows, I just read that to a class recently, it was saying that the performance that you will deliver, if you are surrounded by people who are relatively involved in something that they chase, they have a certain level of performance and stuff, you will be drawn, be pulled up 15%. So whoever you, your circle of people that you spend time with, and if I don't like the term achievers, but let's use it for the sake of discussion. So if they're high achievers, 15%, if you're not that, but just being in that circle pulls you up. Flip side is if you have underachievers, they'll pull you down 30%.
Let's put it this way, a rising tide raises all boats, right?
Perfectly said, you
but
know.
A falling, what is a non-rising tide?
A low tide.
A low tide. Yeah, man.
A lowering tide. lowers all boats as well. But that is the sentiment we have here.
Yeah, yeah. So, and those are the things that we should keep in mind. I wrote something that, and I didn't want to forget, because you also have that connection of people. This is the part I was reading, that just hit home. Says like there's no greater waste of time justifying your actions to people who have a life that you don't want.
Wait, repeat that.
Well, let's sink that in. Take a moment. Go ahead.
And this is where the students, when you say they feel like they want to feel like they fit in. They are prepared to do anything to fit in.
Oh, yeah, high school, that pressure. So repeat that sentence here.
That sentence goes with another thing. I'll repeat this one. It says, there's no greater waste of time justifying your actions to people who have a life that you don't want.
Right, okay. Whew.
And you're going to waste your time trying to please people that you don't want to look like.
Because mm-hmm. in the short term, that'll give you, well, in a way, in high school, status give you a sense of belonging and such, but
oh yeah, there's a follow up on that. It says, if they don't have what you want, don't listen to what they say.
But for that, you need to know what you want. That's far from easy.
But
right?
Sometimes you don't know what you want,
but you know what you don't want. Yes.
Mm. Okay.
And I have this theory in decades. I repeat it a lot when on birthdays, and this is my theory. On decades, so when you're into your 20s, you know everything, and you kind of have this confidence that you want everything, and that's the 20s. We all go through that. And
you want to be the master of the universe, don't you?
And you kind of know what you want. At least you feel like it, right?
You have a sense.
You have a sense. In your 30s, you don't necessarily know what you want, but you know what you don't want. That's in your 30s. In your 40s, you clearly know what you want, and you start planning on doing what you want. Because in your 50s, you do what you want, right? But in your 60s and beyond, you do what you can.
Well, people,
that's my theory in decades. You
know? And I think that hit hard. The greatest waste of time is justifying your actions to people who don't have what you want. And I can think of people in my past that I have a sense of where they are now, and that wouldn't be a life I want. And I feel, for example, very blessed to have two of my closest friends in this room. And I have a relatively small circle, four or five very close friends. And they're all people that, in a way, I admire, and people that I feel like, you know, when I'm around them, they lift me up.
Exactly.
Or they make me better. And that, you know, I know not everybody has that luck. And in high school, I feel like being kind of a, I don't want to say a nerdy outcast, but in that sense, not having that social pressure to fit in kind of allowed me to eventually not care for my own circle and not be stuck with people who, let's say, would drag me down more.
Well, high school is that stage where it's evident and you're trying to make sense of it all, you know, of yourself and the school and your environment and people and stuff. And you truly don't know who you are. You're in that process of defining yourself. In fact, fitting in is a lot of times the easiest thing to be left
feel
alone.
Good about. Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't necessarily feel good, but you're not disturbed. Let's say you feel part of a gang or a group or whatnot, and you're not necessarily that quote unquote type. At least people associate you to a group, and that's reassuring. That's the security, the safety that you're looking for.
You're part of that group. That's who you are. You know, you have that.
Crazy thing I read or found out just recently, just to reinforce that notion, someone was saying that the first Harvard psychological test that they did regarding that, they drew like four lines, and one of them was longer than the others. And then they have people come in a room. Three of them would be actors, but one of them would be the real person that doesn't know anything, and they don't know. And then the person in front, the evaluator, would say, look at the lines and say, which one is the longest line? And the guy would say, like, say the third line is the longest one, evidently. He'd circle number three, but everyone else would circle number one. And the first time he's looking at this, is what the hell's going on, man? No, of course it's. Well, believe it or not, after five or six times, the guy who initially definitely declared that number three was the longest line would change his mind just to fit in. So he would forfeit his own beliefs, his own everything to fit in.
Follow the flock.
And so is that wrong? Is that something bad to do?
It is. It is, because you're forfeiting what your conscience.
Forfeit who you are.
Who you are, your conscience is telling you, what your values, what your beliefs, and you're willing to discard who you truly, what you truly believe in, and to try and satisfy and please, or to be part of the herd.
And it's painful. It's immediately painful not to be part of the herd, and it's immediately gratifying to feel like you're part of the herd, right? So it's especially in high school when fitting in is everything. I think it's very difficult to, let's say, be the one that sticks out, or be the it's because you need that sense of belonging, and you need to feel like you're part of it. You need to feel like be left alone in a way, and it's very painful, I think, for young people to. Yeah. Do that where they allow themselves to feel the pain, the immediate pain of, you know, not fitting in, being their own person. And I think if you're lucky throughout CJEP, throughout university, when you really get to the sense of who you are and you really start to at least picture what you want, you can kind of break out from that. But some people, I think, stay stuck in it. And in a way, you end up with people whose life you don't want. You end up with people who drag you down. And you end up on this life path and it starts there, you know. Mm-hmm. It starts there, and it's very hard. And how would you, how do you allow yourself to stick out?
Yeah, and how do you actually avoid doing that? You know, that the study that you just others. That you just talked about.
I don't have all the answers to begin with. One of the things I could say is, we get a sense of, we all do get a sense of what makes us feel good or what makes us momentarily happy, or we have a sense of right and wrong. We all do have, except if you're a sociopath, but you have that compass in your head that says, look, it feels good to me. And I myself, what I did, I went through sports, and that's how we started this conversation. Mm-hmm. So I was involved in many sports. So my sense of belonging and being part of a group that instilled values that connected or that related with what felt good to me, and would give me a sense of purpose, and that would give meaning to a lot of things. Being part of whatever, a band for music or plays or sports or whatever that is, there are millions of them, you know? So I found my peace to a certain extent doing that, because I also found a way to improve and to learn. So I encourage students a lot to find something that, you know, right now I'm in the process of telling them for my Sec 4 regulars. This is one of my most interesting and passionate. I'm so passionate about this project. When I tell them, I'm just like, I'm so excited, you know, and they buy into it because I'm more excited than they are initially, and then eventually it's just get. So they learn, and it's the how to, and the how to project is they get to choose something that they're passionate about, and they're going to create that tutorial. They're going to explain how to do this. And you don't have any notes. You just, like, you're talking and you're preparing something, like, show that, and this is it. So you're going to show how to change an engine. Mm-hmm. If you're more in mechanic, changing it with a flat tire, or you teach how to cook something or whatever. Cooking, however, I told them, you have to cook enough for everybody plus me.
of course.
So whatever that is,
you gotta benefit a bit from this project.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah, it was a bit tough during COVID, so it was online, but we managed to do it. So at least it gives them a sense of what do I really like? What could I actually share? How can I? What do I have to put out?
And it's up to them. They're not doing it for others. They need to do it for themselves. They don't have a choice. That's a fantastic project.
That's brilliant.
I'm not giving them any agenda.
No.
I have guidelines as to, you got to name the steps. You got to introduce this, and you have to say, my goal is. So we have to set the purpose.
And that I think is brilliant in many ways. Like, for instance, for one, I think it makes the students realize that essentially, like, okay, so I'll do a little parallel. Secondary school for me was like a sort of a simulation of a society, right? Mm-hmm. So you're placed in that environment with people that you interact with and everything, and so there's something that happens and everything. That project, I feel, is like, it makes you realize that what you do has value, mm-hmm. not only for yourself, but that you can learn, you know, to other people, like, okay, here's the value that I have, and here's how, you know, I can teach you, like, show you. And that, I think, it's the fundamentals of, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur or whatever, or like anything
totally.
In life, like, you have value, and that is why people are willing to listen to you or to pay or anything. You know, you have something to give, and that, I think, most of people don't realize that they do have value.
And it's amazing because you're not,
you touched it.
You're not even, you're creating that value from, you're asking yourself, okay, what value, and you're not asking others, because, you know, when you're in a social group, you believe that the value you have is what others like of you. It's what you're doing to fit in. But now here you are asking your students, no, personally, what value can you provide? And not from others, you know, what value can you provide?
And you really nailed it, both of you, because that's why this project is also so important for me, or for them to do. They figure out something that they're actually, I'm interested in that. A couple of them came back, and one of them that she initially she didn't like English at all, I could tell. But then she's associated with someone else, and she said, look, normally it's an individual, but in pairs, this is we both like horseback riding. Can we just like prepare a tutorial where we're going to explain how to take care of the horse? She's going to do that part. I'm going to do the part where I'm on the horse. It's brilliant. Do that. I had a kid bring a car to school. And a car. Project, a car.
Okay.
Because he was into mechanics. That's a crazy story because it's not totally legal.
Okay. Okay. Hold on. Are you sure you want to? There's cameras here.
Yeah,
you
know? I know.
It's
not
totally legal. High school kids.
Crazy thing is that we were reading this book where this kid was not totally kosher and stuff, and he could jumpstart cars, you know, and. he was like, and that's in the story. He's the bad dude. So the guy was not interested in so much in reading in the story, sure. But he says like, yo, that part I dig, you know, I get because I want to be a mechanic. My father's got this garage and I can do this. I said, what do you mean you can do this? You can start a car without the key. Are you sure? He says, can I do that for my how to? He says,
bring your car around, Richard. I'll show you.
He did.
Your car?
Not but my car, but he got his father to put a car in a flatbed truck, brought it to school. The entire class, we left class, went into the parking lot, and he's doing his how-to explain. It wasn't that good initially in English, but he knew all the parts. That's important because you have to, you know. And he says, so this is what you do. You open the door, you do this, and you take this wire, and boom, he started the
car. Did he open the car door without the key?
No, but the car door was open. Okay, it's just explaining that step.
So you didn't give all the steps to break into the cars to the students.
It had to be related to the story, but it was in the story that we were reading. So just I said, maybe it's luck. Why don't you do it a second time? And he did. So that's one of the things that they did. Another time, it was like a student who actually is martial arts.
Okay.
So she showed the entire class how to defend yourself from certain... you know, they take you, kind of a karate jujutsu. Another one is like a Myra dog that she brought to school to explain how they. It's limitless. Now, depending on the principals and how the school can adapt. I said no guns.
That part.
Makes sense. Thank you.
But.
That makes sense.
But.
Canada here.
My hunter can do it at home, film himself, and explain how to do this and have the safety measures, safety tips, and stuff. So. I don't have the guy that's going to be reading and be an academic, but he knows that he can bring something to the world that he's passionate about and that is safe, and he's going to establish a ground rules for other people who share that passion.
And they have no choice but to believe in themselves, that to derive, because they need to. It's on them.
And like, hold on. That I think it like the whole subject is more profound than like what we're talking about, because. One of the reasons that we do the podcast, right, is to give like some tips or maybe like, you know, inspire some people to say, okay, like do something.
If one person is better off after this podcast, then we're happy. Right?
Exactly. But like, oh, you know, do what you like and everything, find your passion and everything. Like, I'm curious to hear about, because what essentially that project, which is like for a semester, right? Like it's pretty short in a lifespan. Can you talk about the process in which the students actually find what they're passionate about? Because I feel that most people are really find it hard to find what they are really passionate about. Oh, yeah. So, like, is there a process there? Is there like some patterns that you can see, like from the years or anything? Like,
something happened yesterday. Something happened yesterday with a student, He likes to do things quick and stuff. And says, Richard, I don't have anything. And I always wanted to do it, how to pick up girls. So he just wanted to get this out of the way and stuff. And initially I said, look, man, why don't you write down a few of the things that you do are things that consciously are, or, you know, or just like tease or pick your brains into make a list of 10 things that you think could, you know, be in that list. And then you narrow it down to your top three. So make a list of these things that you've done or that you do or things that made you feel good at one point or another. Because that had been two classes that he was just diddling around, not knowing and stuff. And then yesterday came up and says, can I do it on investing? So what do you mean investing or drop shipping and stuff? And this is absolutely. Lots of people don't know about that. And I
high school students.
High especially. School student. Yeah. Okay. Don't forget this. I go, yeah, but you want to teach that? This is, yeah. Anyways, he goes, there's drop shipping and investing. So, okay. Now you have to make it accessible to high school students because not every high school student can invest. Oh, but I make money out of it. And he says, okay, I ask him, so you make money, but what's the purpose? Is it just like something that you want to do later? So, no, I'm just having fun with that, and I'm interested in maybe. So it's not going to be the amount of money that you make, but maybe learning about the stock market and everything else. And so, okay, yeah, I can do that because I make money out of stocks. So you want to see? This guy makes $100,000.
What?
Whoa! Back
he
up.
He showed me
high school kid
showed me. Says this is my portfolio. Report, my portfolio. Oh. He had 99,800. This is close to 100,000 that he made in the stock market.
This kid.
Okay. This kid's 16 years old.
This kid is gonna be something else.
And he's doing it just for fun.
I mean, I'm just saying, when you have someone like that, and I believe there's many kids like that out there, but this kid is going to be something else.
But you asked me for the process.
Yeah.
The process was that he didn't know.
Yeah.
What to do his how-to on. But and to prompt him to
what do you
get
like to do?
To what something that he does on the side that he's good
That's
at.
That's crazy.
And he's it's either drop shipping. So I don't know what he's going to pick, but all of a sudden it says, you think, and it said, look, buddy, it's not about you flashing and showing off.
No,
but I have to say.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
He's not
and else, it's not That's about good. You. It's mm-hmm. typically like just to, for you. You have to contribute and you have to help someone to, as you said, pull them up, bring them up, discover something so they can be better off after you've explained this, or at least they gain something. So I get it. So I didn't know, and I didn't even think that he had it in him.
Yeah.
Eventually, I keep it open, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but it's just this guy. And so you ask me what I get from this project over time. Crazy stuff happened.
And in that,
crazy stuff
In that
happened.
Process, you're literally helping the kids discover who they are because they're asking themselves, you know, what do I like to do? Well, they have to ask themselves, and that's amazing.
The crazy thing is that I don't even know. Like, look.
Yeah, he didn't even know that that was something he could teach.
I think that's fundamental. Like, most people don't realize what they can bring to society, that the true value that they can actually, you know, contribute to. But it's right in front of them, like right in front of their nose. That's crazy.
And I want to piggyback on that because there's so many things that happen to us around us and that we look around, we seek out elsewhere. But so many things are either next to us or within us. Mm. We're seeking answers that we have them right there, you know? Quick aside note, and this is a part where I don't want to name names and stuff because I'm part Please. Of an organization, but we're looking for someone to manage to be a general director. And we encourage someone to do it, and then we helped him. We gave him a second interview for him to get the job because we're looking for. And after the time that he was there, it was not a good fit, despite all the things that we did. And then the initial person that we saw didn't want to apply. So when that position became vacant, we went back to that person who had not applied. Says, look, this is your chance. And we think so. And we did everything, you know, and we were just like, and this person like literally took another job. So we were stuck with nothing and having to please someone. But all along, there's someone who was within our group who had never even declared their interest because wanted to be fair and ethical. So when asked, maybe I can do this, you know, because we asked him, said, let me think about it. And you ask me, when do you know it's the right thing? A lot of times when you lack sleep and it keeps running into your head and that thing is running and running and it's always coming back, maybe you have to address it. what you resist persists. So that's the right person that we have now that was there all along. We're looking for, we didn't know.
And I would like to, because we just talked about a project, I want to quickly touch upon another project that not only me, I think impacted many, many people in our Sec 5 class. You remember the speeches, right?
I do.
Oh, yeah. No, okay. So let me contextualize this. First, beginning of the year, Richard is like, okay, so welcome to English Enriched, right? We're having a good time. And then he's like, okay, so there's going to be a big project, right? And at the end of this school year, you are going to stand up on the podium, and they built a really nice stage. Yeah. Le Centre Québécois, that's where shows happen. You have a whole row. Like, it's how many seats? Like, a few hundred?
400.
400 seats, a big stage. And he tells us, you're going to stand up in front of the class, and you're going to give a speech. How long? 5, 10 minutes?
5 minutes.
Five minutes speech, good English, and you're going to talk about something. What? Well, that's indeterminate as of yet, but you're going to talk about something, you know, you care about. And many kids, like, you're alone in this, and you're presenting on the biggest stage in the school. You're not just doing a little PowerPoint presentation with your team. You're alone. So many students are already terrified of this. And you're starting to think at the very beginning of the year, okay, well, what the hell am I going to talk about, right? And from what I remember, I mean, I remember enjoying the process of building my own speech. I took a few quotes from Kung Fu Panda, Master Oogway. Very wise.
They were very funny and it's wise, too.
It's a good quote. And it's like, I'll just say it just for fun. It's like, tomorrow is a mystery. Yesterday is history, but today is a gift. And that's why we call it the present. But anyway, so, yeah. But I remember the speeches that marked me most were from some of my classmates. Obviously, I won't name names, but some of them really put their demons and confronted something in themselves.
Right.
And I mean, they broke down after the speech.
Exactly.
It's like, it's this big moment. And what did you envision for this project? Because clearly it impacted some people very significantly. And I think some of them were holding something in that they finally confronted. It was a tough process for some people. And I think it a very good one, but
it's meant to be.
Yeah,
it's meant to be tough. It's meant to be as well. At the beginning of the year, I want you to know exactly what you will have to do to accomplish. And I picked what is hard, and among the hardest things to do is to speak in public. And I said it at the beginning. I said
especially in high
some
school,
people.
Everybody's watching. Your perception.
Some people are less afraid of death than speaking in public. Okay, and I want to take the hardest thing, because if you can accomplish the hardest thing and do it and survive, which everybody does, then many of your fears, projected fears that you're not enough, fears
inadequate.
That you're not going to be loved, and those are the two main fears that we have. And when you surpass that, then I think you're left with something that more, I guess. And that's why I wanted to put you and everyone else through that process to make you realize that you have more within you to share.
And you think.
And I use this story, and I don't know if you remember that, because my initial thing...
Is it the jump?
Yeah.
Yes, tell it. Here we go. Oh, I want... give us the... So this, you use this story to inspire us, right?
Well...
To inspire, something we didn't think we could do.
Exactly, but to inspire, but also to put in context, and because that story essentially is when I say, I ask you for your defining moment, and I ask you to write about this very early in the year. And that's like in your back pocket. You don't realize it, but you've already imprinted that in your hard drive. We're going to get back to it later. So you're going to reach out that file, pull it out, and then we're going to work on it. So my story, when I say my defining moment happened when I was 10 years old. Why 10 years old? It's true. Because everyone was 10 years old at one point. I could talk about the national championships we won or whatever. I could talk about different things, but that's people don't relate. 10 years old, elementary school. I'm jumping in the schoolyard, and they organize some kind of activity, and they put the mats on the ground so we don't hurt ourselves. So put one mat, and they tell people just run and jump. Me being overexcited, as you know, I just didn't want to jump on the mat, you know, and look at the mats. I jump past the mat. That was my goal. So they put one mat, jump past the mat. And that was it. And they put a second mat. I look, so now I got a challenge. Ran, jump, and cleared the second mat. They put the third mat on. I ran, jump, and I didn't clear it. But I was quite happy. I tried a couple of times and stuff. That's it. So a day goes by, or I can't remember how long, and then teacher comes and says, hey, we have this competition at the University of Sherbrooke where all the elementary school kids will be there and they'll compete. You want to represent our school for a long jump? I said, sure, you know. Walking back home, I'm thinking, I'm going like, oh, wait a minute. I'm going to represent the school.
Well, I just agreed to.
Hey, exactly. I said, what did I say yes to and that I have no idea? So already, you're facing the unknown, right? But it came out of a, you know, interest and curiosity. So I tell my mom, you know, I'm going to do this and stuff. And mom said, oh, yeah, you know, it's going to go fine. My dad, and I said, you know, Dad, I'm kind of nervous. I says, hey, yo, do your best, you know, and the hell with the rest. That's basically his quote. So it's, no, it's do your best. So I go back and I come to university. There's no one from my school. I'm the only one. That's a whole bunch of kids from everywhere. And they line us up in front of that running in the pit, you know, the sand pit, just like for the long jump. For me, I was used to jumping over mats or on mats. And now the context, the environment changes. So I have to adjust to a new reality. And I'm looking at this. It's, wait a minute. So the line is so long that you can hear other people talk. I'm trying to socialize, but I'm also getting more and more nervous and anxious. And I hear this kid saying, like, oh, yeah, but they had mats, too. Oh, yeah, I cleared three mats and stuff. And, yeah, it's pretty good. I didn't clear three mats. The other kid says, oh, me, I cleared four mats, man, and stuff. And that wasn't even a good day.
You know? Already you're not good enough, you know?
I'm hearing this, and I'm going, like, what the hell? And four mats. And he goes, well, my record is five. We're 10 years old, so we believe everything that everyone says. And I'm going, like, this guy's got wings, man. How come he can clear? And he says, what am I doing here? So already I'm hearing all these things, and I'm having this story and that I'm building in my head, and I'm also trying to find ways not to do this anymore. I don't like this anymore. So as the line is getting closer to my turn to jump, not there yet, and I can physically to this day see myself drift outside the line to not do this anymore. And I even let a couple people go by because I can't make sense of this in my head, being here, having to do this when all these people are there and I got no friends. But then I said, if I leave, what am I going to tell my parents? I have options. Am I going to lie? No, I could. I'm going to have to live with a lie. Yeah. Am I going to just go run and just like jump and there, I did it? My dad asked me to just give it my best. What am I going to tell him? And I'm going like, okay, look, there's only one option. And I'm looking at the pit. I'm looking at this. And at the moment I started focusing on the reason why I was there, I could not hear people.
What was that reason, Richard?
The reason was to run and jump as far as I could. That's why I was there. As simple as that. So I started looking at this, and I started looking at, you know, how far I should run and how I should place my body. And as you know, for long jump, there's a bar on the ground, and there's gum. So if there's an imprint of gum, your jump doesn't count. And I had two tries. So I want to clear the first one, so I'm going to be a little more conservative. So I'm trying in my mind to see where I'm going to put my foot. Already I'm conceiving how strategically I can perform the act for which I was here. And I can't hear anything. And so my turn comes. I run, clear the first jump. It's good. And I cleared it fairly away from the bar almost, just to make sure, but almost on. So now the second try, walking back, I'm already thinking about my second jump. And I'm already thinking, okay, now I can, maybe if I run one step closer, I'm going to get closer to that gum, but that's the risk, a calculated risk that's going to help me go further, and maybe I can jump a little higher to get some distance. And I'm already thinking this. And in the line, I'm only focusing on and visualizing. I'm 10 years old. I don't know all these things, but that's what's playing out in my head. And I do the second jump, clear it. Happy, go back home, talk to my mom. Dad asks, did you give it your best? Yeah, yeah. So go back to school. And then a day or two go by, and I'm called to the principal's office. So I'm asking myself, what the hell did I do that I don't know that I did? You know? And principal asks me, he says, you went to that competition? Yeah, yeah, I went. Anything bad went? Cause, and that principal was really intimidated. So
oh, they all are.
They all are, yeah. So he says, how well do you think you did? He says, I have no idea. You know, I just went there. He says, you won gold medal. So I'm like, what? I said, what about the kid who had wings and cleared five mats and all this? No, 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 you won gold medal. So what I tell the students is, had I listened to the voices outside telling me that I interpreted, that told me that I wasn't good enough or that I didn't belong, had I listened to my own voice telling me that I didn't have what it takes, had I concocted some kind of story and lived with a lie or lived with the knowledge that I didn't give it my all, what would this have been? How would that thing, you know? And I tell him, just look, that has changed me, and it's also impacted everything I do and how I educated my sons. I said, this is my defining moment. What's yours? Yeah. And that moment is so insignificant for 99.9% of the people on the planet. I tell them that. This story is about some 10-year-old kid running and jumping, but it made a difference to me.
Mm. And so contextualizing back in the speech project, that's how you explained in a way what you were looking for, what the type of introspection you were looking for this project. And people had to look at, in a way, had to look at, once again, who they were, because they had to look at, okay, well, what's that moment?
And what matters to you?
Exactly.
And what matters to you? So, and that's one of the moments at high school, we don't always get the time to reflect on what matters to me. We always pushed a lot of things, and or we think we're interested in something, and this is it, you know. And
even in university, I feel like you start, you know, doing a program or anything. Mm-hmm. The initial interest may be there, sure, but there isn't that like update, you know. And I feel like most people, that's the case, you know. Like you just follow along, and everything goes well or not, anyways. But yeah, that introspection, I feel like it's a difficult process, very difficult, because, you know, you need to put some time. Mm-hmm. And the most difficult part is that you may know the goal, but you don't know what will be the impact of that. Like, I mean, I can do some introspection, think about myself, but like the end thing is unclear, or maybe it's painful to accept. Like, for example, if you do some like that, and you realize, okay, no, I'm not in a good place right now. So you need to make some changes. Like, making some changes is very hard, because you build up everything that you have as of right now, and you need to say, okay, that's not the good, and I cannot envision myself doing that for the next number of years. So I think that's like.
And if I may, there's your son's in law, right? One of your sons.
My oldest son is a lawyer.
Yeah. And he's you told me he's in a law firm.
Yeah, in Montreal.
Yeah, well, see, right now, that what relates is me and Charles, we went into this program called MBA Law, and we had this vision kind of for ourselves. I wouldn't say the black sheep, but in our head, we were like, well, we don't want it for the law. Law's a good tool. We want it for the business side. We want to be in business. And there's something called La Course au Stage, which you probably know. It just happened, right?
Yeah.
This Friday. This Friday with the offers, right? Yeah. And initially, in our first 2 years, we were like, oh, La Course au Stage, that's a lawyer thing. It's you go into large law firms. You don't have a life there. It's terrible. It's terrible. And we don't want to do that. We want to be in business. So to hell with that, you know. And one of the things that I love is that we, you know, we just both did it. Mm-hmm. We both did like also said, and we're both envisioning starting our careers as lawyers. And the reason why, thank you. The reason why it was a fun process. The reason why I feel good about it is because it's kind of a process that's pushed upon anybody in law school. Like, you know, that's the thing to do. You become a lawyer, you go into a large law firm, that's where you live out your life. But we made it there on our own terms. Like, we initially didn't want to go there. And by, you know, only a crazy man doesn't change. But we made it there by evolving and by re-questioning ourselves. Like, okay, well, what is this? What can we do? And by talking to some of the lawyers at the firm, you know, a lot of them become business advisors. That's right up my alley, at least. And we now have the offers we want from large law firms to start our careers. And, you know, in re-questioning ourselves and opening ourselves up to that, I can speak for myself, but I feel confident that, you know, okay, I'm not just going there because that's the thing people do. I re-question myself. I had that introspection, and I know that's where I want to start. I have my reasons. And the reason I'm bringing this up now is because I think, as you were saying, in university, there's a lot of people who go into law, especially UDM, McGill, that's day one, Cursus Stage, and they don't question why they're going there. And in a career, in any career, but in a career where you're going to put 50 to 60 hour weeks, you need to find your own purpose. Because if you're just doing it because it's the thing to do, you're going to wake up maybe at 30, 35, hopefully younger, and you're going to realize, wow, I'm not happy here. This is not where I want to be. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Totally.
And that's going to be a much harder impact than doing it right now. And I'm so happy that we had that introspection and we decided on our own terms, you know, this is where we want to go. Yeah, we've opened ourselves up to it.
And, you know, it's applicable to high school as well. So you know, like people maybe go in high school, like they don't really have purpose of why they are learning things. Probably they just go because maybe they're, you know, it's mandatory, you need to do this or to have the higher grades possible, you know. Like, I feel like those kind of projects gives you time to think about what you want and maybe give you a sense of purpose.
It does, and actually, on what you were saying, there's something that Jim Carrey said as well.
He's
like
terrific.
Amazing person, and very spiritual as well in his own ways. Although he's very funny and all that, but he's got the depth that people would
they miss for his humor.
Absolutely, but he I took it from one of his speeches, and he says, like, so many of us choose our path out of fear. Disguise that's practicality. And it's incredible and so powerful. And from the example that he drew from his father, like the experience of his father who took up a job that he didn't like and then got laid off, he says you can fail at what you don't like.
Yeah.
Remember? So when you think of the choices that you have to make, you also and to follow up on what he says, why not take a chance on what you love?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think when you love something, someone, time is not so much of the essence. And time is, yes, you may want to achieve things at a particular moment or whatnot, but when you love it, you will go through experiences and challenges that I call your test of conviction. How much you love it, you will have those tests of convictions. So when you decided that you want and you love something, then somehow the universe is gonna say, "Oh yeah, you said you love it. That's how much."
Yeah.
And then you have this blindside thing that just falls on you, and then do you still love it? And then you get this either in the relationship or do you still love it?
Yeah.
And then when you pass through these tests of conviction, and a little bit like Churchill used to say, told you about the quotes, it says, success is like going through failure without losing your enthusiasm. So it's failing time and time again without losing your enthusiasm. That's his definition of success, you know? So I think that in life and for things that you love, well, you will have these challenges and you will have these tests of conviction. So what to, in choosing what you want to do, if what your involvement requires those number of hours that you say, then it's worth it. It's no longer a matter of a time and everything. I mean, I use my youngest son, for example. He's an international speed skater. I don't know if you know, but
Jordan.
So I have a lot of experiences, and in a way, I could cheat a bit because he was my laboratory.
What do you mean?
My laboratory. He knows it. It's just like so many of the things that I learned and shared. He was open to receiving them. He was very willing to hear me out and to take a chance on certain things. So we have a high level of trust, but he was also willing to question stuff. And the day I knew that he could do well, we don't know how well, it's when he made it to the team as 15th skater, whatnot, and he wasn't even on the team. We had this conversation, and he says, "Dad, you know what? I realized that I really like training." Because my fear, no, not a fear, but my issue that I had with him, since he was very, very passionate. He was like very, you know, he loved to do stuff, but I didn't know how disciplined he would be to perform at an international level where that is pretty much your fuel.
Yeah,
still love it. Basically.
And still love it. And when I was saying to love what you hate to do, when he said, "I really like training," since I said, "Great, because 95% of the time, that's all you're going to be doing. You're going to be training. That 5% is your reward."
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like when we love something, well, 95, 80, 90% of the time, it's not necessarily what you love that's going to jump at your face. It's what you need to do to sustain the love that you have. So that's why I'm making that parallel.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. And maybe on another tangent, what is the most beautiful thing in your life right now? What do you appreciate the most?
What I appreciate the most, I'm going to say, because if my wife listens to that, she might know that I appreciate her presence and the fact that she's the woman she is, and to have helped me raise children that I totally, totally love deeply, unconditionally. My biggest success, that when you say, you talk about that, is it's my sons. Mm-hmm. To see where they're at, not because of what they're accomplishing, because of who they are, who they became.
And to add to that, you just said not because of what they're accomplishing, because this is something I want to come back to, and this is a good time to it. We're not defined only by what we do. So you're proud of your sons, you're proud of who they are, and what are you proud of, who they are, but what is that?
Specifically, I'm proud of the courage they demonstrate in whatever they take on. I'm proud of the values that they put they keep deeply within themselves and that they adhere to. I'm proud of the fact that they don't feel they need to follow the herd to be happy about things and the way they develop. I'm happy about the fact that family is at the heart of who they are. Right now, as we speak, both of them, after the World Championships in the Netherlands, traveled together to see my niece in Italy. But while they were in the Netherlands, after, I have another niece in Utrecht. That's where they were, both of them. And now they're in Italy playing with the other two kids, and they're going to have time for themselves. But when they come here, it's never a burden to go visit the family and stuff. It's that sense of belonging, they still have it. So, and at the age that they are at, it's something that I think is important. When you ask in the question happiness, you know, and there was a long, long study that most people talk about in that story, 100 years to define the happiness. And essentially, to sum it up, it was what made the people happy, regardless of where what the status was. It's again the people that they valued and that brought value to them, their lives, their friends, the choice of their friends, and all these, and the fact that this family, to a certain point, extended or that had meaning for them. So I think that they got this. They got this, and they express it freely, and they're not stopped by any standards. And the courage, I come back to that, because there are decisions that they made that could go against the grain or could go against whatever, but they pull through, both of them, in their respective fields of interest. And I find that very, very rewarding as a parent, because
you want to see your kid be the person they are for themselves. You want to see them.
The thing is, and that's what I unfortunately noticed that some parents forget, we raise our children for them to no longer need us.
Yeah.
We raise our children for them to become independent. They can consult us after, but they have to be their own person. Example, I like the analogy, the parallel with the eagles, right? The eagles, and I don't know if I told you that.
Oh, no, I remember that.
Because the eagles, essentially, when they raise their chicks, they put them in a comfortable bed, you know, in the highest point. But slowly, as the chick grows, they remove all this, and what you have underneath, pricks and uncomfortable stuff that, you know, bother the chick because its wings had taken and expanded. So the chick is no longer comfortable in that nest. Hmm. So the chick eventually is kind of almost picked up when the parent knows that the chick is ready, but the chick doesn't know it is. Parent picks up the tall eagles with the talon, picks up the chick and drops it. And the chick eventually has to flap its wing. Doesn't work the first time. Eagle knows before the chick crashes, picks it up. We'll try tomorrow. Up until the chick is dropped to literally spread its wings and starts to fly. The chick was not born to stay in that nest. Yeah. The chick was born to use its wings, learn to hunt, and become its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we lose a sense of that when we're raising kids to protect them from everything and anything.
You want to protect them from the world, but you can't.
But we weren't protected that much as adults, and we're thinking that I'm not going to let my kid go through what I went through because that was so painful. I don't want you. But
kid has to go through what they're going to go through.
There's certain things that you can protect them, and if they're connected to your values, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But for the rest, there's a lot of stuff that they went through. I don't know. I don't need to know. But I'm looking at them today. Did they learn something from that? Are they better off because of that? Or am I sure that they're not going to repeat that from a conversation? And then we know. But the rest of it, they're going to have to take responsibility for whatever their decisions are. And I'm going to be there if they need me. And that's unconditional. So that's why I'm saying that's the part I'm proud of about them.
They're their own person. And it's a beautiful thing you said, because as parents, it's the hardest thing that you can do, I imagine. Or listen, I have no idea. I'm speaking out of, you know, but you can tell me. I get the sense that one of the hardest thing for a parent to do is to kind of
let go,
relinquish control of that. You can't stop your kid from going through terrible things. You can't stop them from, but you can always be there when they need you in that process, but they have to go through it.
There's one little detail in that. It's because growing up, if they were in an environment that encouraged them to believe in themselves, if they were, and I'm talking about students, I'm talking about anybody, if you are growing in an environment that allows you as well to make a certain number of mistakes, knowing that it's not the end of the world, it's the part of the process. If you grow up in an environment where you can dream up things, and or you can even conceive things, as a child, like we did, and that you say, look, why not? Instead of why not? So I think that we could go a long way.
Foster that environment.
And this is what you're asking me, what really, really motivates me in teaching. That is a part of it, to see these kids and see, look, you're a hell of a lot more than you. I see you. You don't see it, but I see you further down the road being a lot bigger or more than what you think you are right now. Yeah. And that's a source of motivation, again, to this day, in my teaching.
And I have a last question, if I may, and I think it'll be a beautiful cherry on top. I'm going to ask it like Lex Friedman asks it. What's the meaning of this whole thing? Why are we here? What is the meaning of life?
Well, funny that you said that.
We got a page
for
it.
How will I serve the world? How will I serve the world? What does the world need that my talent can provide? How will I serve the world? And when we're talking about happiness, Le Petit Prince, written by
Saint-Exupéry.
And when he was asked, one of his famous quotes is the shortest but the most meaningful. It says, you want happiness? Give it.
Wow.
You want to be happy? Give happiness. So what is the purpose of it all? I think it's for us to be ourselves, to learn who we are maybe in the process, but also to not necessarily to think that I'm going to create something so wonderful and big, but if within myself I can find a certain level of happiness, a certain level of peace, and a certain level of meaning to what I do and who I am, and that I can pass it on or help other people discover that treasure, because I believe that we all have this gem within ourselves, this light that requires to shine, whatever it is. And my goal is perhaps to throw that flashlight and say, see, I see light there. Did you see it?
And that's such a beautiful bow tie on this discussion, because in order to know how we can best serve the world, it comes back on so many things. We need to know ourselves, to believe in ourselves. And that touches on so many different things that we've talked about in this conversation. And I think you're not asking yourself, what's the meaning of life? You're not putting yourself forward. You're saying, what can I do for the world? How can I be how is myself, my best version, how can that help the world advance? And that's a beautiful thing.
Well, touch on things. You always have haters. Yep. You always have people to do that. But as we said, if you give attention to the people that have nothing to offer to you, this is where it's a misguided attention. There's a quote, and I love this one. It says, haters are there holding their breath, waiting for you to fail. Let them suffocate.
Well, listen, Richard, tremendous discussion. Thank you very much for your time. It was really fun.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me here and discussing this. It's always a pleasure. And you're a great example of the meaning I'm looking for.
Thank you.
You're doing great stuff, great job, and long vie.
Thank you very much.
Hopefully maybe to the future, because there's a lot of points that we didn't even touch on, but we only have 2 hours. So.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Jelly.
Thank you.
Well, that was a hell of a discussion, Paul.
That is one way to say it. That was a hell of a discussion. Not 1 minute wasted. Every syllable.
What's the moment that stand out for you?
Well, for me, less of a moment and more the general person that is Richard. I mean, I'm always reminded of this when I see him, but how optimistic, positive, and grateful he is in life. And he's had difficult times, and he's gone through a lot of things. And we could have kept going 4 hours in this discussion with a ton of sob stories and difficult moments. And to see how he's gone through them, reflected upon them, and now has this ability to transmit to other people that are going through tough times how to get out of them, and just the overall energy he has, how grateful he is about life. For me, that just made my day, honestly, and I think we could all learn something from having someone like that in our lives.
Absolutely. And for myself, I think it's the way he teaches, especially for those specific projects, because I think that overall, a lot of people, or almost all the people, don't realize how they can add value to society. And that simple project that, you know, he asks his students to do, it's just, it makes them realize that, okay, I have a skill, I can teach it, so here's the value that I can give to society. And I think that's applicable to everyone.
And he's not even an English teacher. He's a teacher of life.
Absolutely.
Who happens to teach an English class.
In English, yeah.
Well, as always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas of guests, email us at millionvoidesucces@gmail.com. And we always love to get your advice. And hopefully, you'll love this discussion.
Tu fais partie d'un programme d'études en régime coopératif et tu as envie de partir travailler à l'international pendant tes études? Les stages hors Québec sont faits pour toi. Saisis cette opportunité, viens nous rencontrer au service des stages et du développement professionnel sur le campus principal au local B6 2005 ou visite le site usherbrooke.ca/stage. Cette émission est commanditée par le service des stages et du développement professionnel.